For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Visit us online at faith.yale.edu.
The artist has the ability to direct the attention of the audience. If you agree to engage with their work, then they will show you something, and you agree to pay attention to that thing. And I think the act of attending to things is basically the act of love. And when I look at, you know, the life of Christ, he's forever drawing people's attention to things as lessons or just things they wouldn't have seen otherwise, a person they would have passed by or like a lesson from nature or something that they would have missed. That discipline and virtue of attention flies directly in the face of everything that we experience today.
This is For the Life of the World, a podcast about seeking and living a life worthy of our humanity. I'm Evan Rosa with the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. In the constant urgency of digital life, we are learning more and more that we live in an attention economy. Almost all day long, mostly without thinking about it, we buy and sell in the currency of attention. The phone notification, the crying child, the email, the doom scroll through infinitely refreshing online media, the texts, the demand for a daily dose of outrage, and the lie that your attention can be directed everywhere at once. Indeed, even folks like Sam Harris, once known for his new atheism, now want to befriend you as your friendly neighborhood podcast voice spiritual guide, facilitating and helping you leverage the most important resource we all possess, our attention. Good to call to mind here, the simple reminder of our agency from Wendell Berry, that we can pursue the, quote, joy of sales resistance. And while we might amend that for today as the joy of screen resistance, what is the place of entertainment, particularly movies and film and TV, in a flourishing life? In today's episode, Drew Collins welcomes Alyssa Wilkinson to the show. She's a film critic and culture reporter for Vox, and is Associate Professor of English and Humanities at the King's College in New York City. She's author of How to Survive the Apocalypse, Zombies, Cylons, Faith, and Politics at the End of the World. And she has bylines with Rolling Stone, The Washington Post, Vulture, The Atlantic, The Los Angeles Review of Books, Paste, and many others. I want to start by queuing up Alyssa's definition of art, as that will lay a foundation for the rest of her reflections on reading, watching, and the prospects and pitfalls of entertainment. And one of the most important aspects of that is the interplay between creator and audience. She says that there's a mystical quality about the shared experience of people experiencing art together, and that it takes both the artist and the audience to bring their whole selves to the picture for art to live up to the potential of what it truly could be.
So I have a working definition of art that I use with my students for a long time. I walk into class and I'm like, so today we're going to learn what art is, everybody. And they're like, but I always think of it as the product of human culture. So the thing humans make that requires both a creator and an audience to be complete. So in that context, a sunset is not art, unless you could call God the artist or something, but that feels like it's just a poster now that you get at the Christian bookstore. A human made it. I think I could write a book and shove it in a drawer. And I have written a book, and that's a great thing that I have done. But it doesn't really become like an artwork, which is like a living, breathing thing, until I share it with someone else. And at that point, it's perceived or it's read. And now we have a different category, like a phenomenological category of a thing. And so I don't really have a problem with people coming up with a story in order to illustrate a point. I just don't feel the need to call that art. Also, there can be bad art, just to be clear. Like, art is not a value category. It's just a category for me. Propaganda exists and can have its uses. And there are other categories of things that use the same material as works of art or even are the same structure. But I think it becomes a work of art. It takes on that extra mystical quality when it's shared between people. And the amazing thing, and this is what I especially love about movies, is that we're all sitting in the theater and we're all seeing the same movie, but we're all actually seeing a slightly different piece of art. Like, it's hitting us each differently. And that's part of why I can come out and be like, that was terrible. And someone else can be like, that changed my life. And we've seen the same movie. Like, we literally saw the same movie at the same time. Same color grading, like nothing was different. Most artists are really into this idea. It's hard to find an artist who's like, no, I don't want you to think anything except what I want you to think. But you will definitely find other kinds of people who want to use art for their own purpose to only get across one idea. And I think there are uses and abuses of that, but I don't want to call it art, and I don't want to engage with it as art either. I don't really see it as a work of art, and it doesn't bear the same category of scrutiny as if I'm looking at a propaganda poster or I'm looking at a piece of advertising or something like that. I find this useful for me in thinking about, what do I actually want to engage with? What can I bring the tools of criticism to, which is not about criticizing, but is about opening it up, and what things close themselves down. The other paradigm that I find useful here is Jean-Luc Marion's ideas about idols and icons. I've thought about this a lot with respect to art, that a really incredible work of art is one that invites you to look through it to the greater presence beyond the thing itself. And you often know you're engaging with a bad work of art or something that kind of fails to be art entirely if it, like, your gaze stops at the object and there's just nowhere to go. It will not even reflect back on you. It's just like, I am here to be worshipped. These are semi-useful tools, but I think they're good for engaging.
In the remainder of this conversation, Alyssa reflects on how her early life formed her critical and cultural sensibilities, the role of entertainment in a flourishing life, how biblical interpretation lends itself to the attentive task of the critic, the challenges of boredom and seeing entertainment as mere consumption, and how creating art and watching film well cultivates the virtues of attention and hospitality. And of course, much more, including the saddest song in a movie soundtrack, why her podcast is called Young Adult Movie Ministry, the uselessness of singing, why film is not a storytelling medium, and how the prophet Daniel is an exemplar of public engagement for our day. Enjoy.
I'm so excited to get to talk to you. We've been talking about this for a long time.
Awesome.
Reading and watching movies and these sorts of things, the stuff that you focus on in your work, are things that we start doing very young. These are not things that you come to later in life usually. I've got three kids downstairs, and all they want to do is read books and watch TV. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, what were some of your earliest memories of reading and listening and, of course, watching?
Yeah.
How do you think those might have influenced or shaped the trajectory and the place you find yourself in now?
Yeah, I love that question. I started reading very young. So I was like the youngest kid in my kindergarten class. And then I was, I think, the first one to start reading. Like, I took to it, like, I don't know, fish in water. That's a boring cliche. And I went to like private Christian school through fifth grade and then was homeschooled after that. And I grew up in a house where we had a TV, but we didn't really watch it. Like, maybe PBS was the most that I would have ever watched. We weren't really into movies, or certainly not cinema or anything like that. My parents didn't go to college. They're both very smart people. And my dad was very, in particular, very interested in culture, but they tended toward, I guess, what you might call high culture things when they were giving them to us as kids, or Christian stuff. I was definitely the kid who just read through the entire children's division at both the public library and the church library, read a lot of classic literature. So a lot of what I was reading was fiction mostly, or stories of real people and their lives. And then I played music. So I started playing the piano when I was like 7, and then a bunch of other different instruments, became a church musician. A lot of what I listened to was also classical music, right, basically. And that was my world. There's probably a half dozen movies that I've seen a million times, but they're like Jimmy Stewart movies. I have been catching up to have cultural touch points in common with my peers, but it's taken most of my adulthood to feel like I know what they're talking about some of the time, which is like a weird background, although not an altogether unusual one for a film critic, I'm finding out. Because what you learn, I think, from reading so much is like how to read a text. You know, you don't just read the text for the plot. You also like character development and understand symbols. And of course, when you grow up evangelical, or at least the kind I did, which was like we read the Bible a lot, you also learn a lot about like the tools you actually need in order to watch a movie, which is like thinking about symbols or like patterns or echoes that you see or typologies. That all translates very well into learning how to read a movie, understanding cinema, seeing how filmmakers construct their stories, and certainly writing as well. I've always thought of myself as more of a cultural critic who happens to mainly write about film, right, than a film person. I don't really have any formal film training. But the tools of criticism are all about reading a text, understanding it, and being able to reinterpret it and re-narrate it back to the audience in some way so that they can like feel free to have their own experience with it or to argue with you or whatever.
Yeah. What I hear you saying is that you learned how to read and to watch. That's been a constant, that's grown, and its seeds are planted from an early age. But the what you're watching and reading and listening to has changed.
Yes. I think one good part of it as a critic is that I don't actually have a nostalgic attachment to a lot of the pop culture that a lot of my peers do. And especially in this age of like very little original content and a lot of nostalgia content coming out, I think it gives me the advantage of almost feeling like I grew up in a different country, although that's almost nonsensical, but that's the idea.
Yeah.
It makes a difference.
If the how is constant in some sense or connected, but at the same time, what you are focusing on reading, what you're being entertained by, I guess, has changed to some extent. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about why you think you are reading and watching and listening to what you are being entertained by now.
Yeah. I was thinking about this recently because the easy answer with movies is I just watch literally every movie because it's my job, but that's not actually totally true. I get to pick and choose, and there definitely are things that I'm watching because I'm like, I gotta watch it for work. And then there's a lot that I get to choose. And so for instance, one of my particular interests and things that I make sure I seek out is like creative nonfiction filmmaking. So documentary, but documentary that's I have nothing against Ken Burns, but I'm not sitting around watching talking heads. It's usually films that are thinking about like observational behavior, just like watching people go about what they're doing, or films that like actively challenge the way we look at things and the way that we see things. So they make us rethink our visual vocabulary. I think those are really of interest to me for a couple of reasons. One is it's just the general cultural milieu of like post-truth, if we want to call it that, or just those ideas that we're watching lots of stuff, but often without a lot of thought about the act of watching. So I'm interested in that. And those are movies that I would seek out. And I find myself doing the same thing when I'm reading a book. Like sometimes I just want to sit down and read a plot, but usually I find that really unengaging. I need something on the meta level or something that's giving me the sense that the author is thinking not just of giving me something, but like of interacting with or grabbing me and dragging me back into the book in some way. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that. I think most of my favorite authors are people who kind of work on that level. And that's what engages me. That's what makes me want to keep going with it.
Yeah. I get this sense in contemporary culture more broadly, but definitely in Christian culture, I think we've come to this place where when we talk about what we watch or where we find our entertainment, it can't go against the things that we believe are true and good, but it sits outside of those concerns. I think
right.
We don't have to justify watching American Idol to other people. It's just, I'm tired. Yeah. I've had a long day and I want to turn off. But what I see in you is quite the opposite, right? You've come to pop culture and to this engagement that is very much turned on.
Yes, that's the hope, right? So certainly during the pandemic, I found myself being like, I just can't. I'll watch a lot of shows that I know are like actively bad, but I am actually engaging, I hope, when I watch them. I just love these shows, but I do enjoy watching them and seeing how and why they're bad, right? Yeah. Like that kind of like developing your taste thing, I think can be good for people to even engage and to recognize. And this is a thing that comes up in criticism a lot these days, that saying that it's bad doesn't mean that I'm saying either you're bad if you like it or that nobody should ever watch it. I'm just like acknowledging that I know this isn't attempting to engage the audience or these characters make no sense or there's all these places we could go with this. That's not a moral judgment necessarily, but it is, it's the equivalent of me going to McDonald's and being like, that was really bad for me and it tasted delicious and I will eat it again someday. And that's fine, I think. But I do think people don't think about art in terms of nutrition that they're like taking into themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's, and also that it's not like eating your vegetables. It's not exactly like a chore. It's just that we have to develop a palate for interesting, challenging content, not sad content necessarily, just like things that nourish us in important ways.
I get the sense from your writing that it's not one of the ways which is different from eating your vegetables, right? Is that it's not only for you in a sense.
Yes.
I saw recently you just wrote a post about going back to the theaters. And I wonder if you could talk about the sort of communal or public context of entertainment. We talk about it in such a privatized way. We even talk about ourselves as consumers, what we consume, the music you consume, not listen to or enjoy. What do you think is going on there? How do you think we should think about it differently?
Yeah, I've actually been thinking about this because I'm writing and researching a little bit about public funding for the arts, which is like a thing that the US has done in kind of waves the last 100 years or so. I have a post-it stuck next to me that says, is the problem that we don't think of art as a public thing? Is that why it's actually hard to convince people that it's a public good like your water system? And it actually, crass economic perspective, it brings in more money than lots of industries we support wholeheartedly to the US. So like, why don't we think of it that way? And there's all these factors. A big one is there's just a lot of it now. So it's physically impossible. I just wrote about the Friends reunion and I was remembering watching that myself in college, crammed into a dorm room. And I just looked it up and 52 million people watched it that night. 52 million people don't watch anything anymore, like maybe the Super Bowl. But other than that, there's no show on television that would ever even approach that. Like a good Game of Thrones day is like 8 million. Yeah. So that's a issue. And I don't even know that it's actually a huge problem. Like there are up and downsides to having a monoculture that centers around popular culture because whoever controls it controls the narrative about the culture. And that has definitely had some detrimental effects, largely because it's been like rich white dudes for so long. And that is a perspective on the world, but it's only one of them. So there's upsides and downsides to that, but that of course means that communal experience is harder to come by, which is why I'm such a firm believer in movie theaters. Also just regular theaters, I think, where you go see a play, like that will really shock you if you haven't done it in a while by the intimacy that you feel with your fellow audience members, even for a very large play. It's really odd. I'm also this is why we need sports. Like sports give us that place. That's a place we do have those communal experiences. I'm not a philosopher, but I'm sure there are a ton of really clear philosophical reasons that experiencing like catharsis and like emotion and all kind of being pointed towards the same goal are important. But I think for a lot of people, loneliness is it's an epidemic. It's a problem. And it also gives us permission, I think, to have those emotions. I definitely never laugh when I watch a movie by myself, but I definitely do if I'm with other people because I'm like learning to perform my emotions. And there's a case to be made that for a long time, religious experience or at least like religious observance was that for a lot of people. And that certainly has dropped off drastically. I was interviewing Paul Schrader. I interviewed him several times after First Reformed came out. And he talks a lot about how, oh, you go to a Taylor Swift concert, which he has done. He's a big Taylor Swift fan. And you go to a mega church and you're going to have similar emotional experiences. And he doesn't really mean it as a critique, but I do think remembering that those are the experiences we have together, I think that's really important. And when I was talking to people about movie theaters, that was one of the big things they brought up, was they realized how much of their emotional experience of a work of art, which is a healthy thing to have, mm-hmm. is based on being around other people. The other thing they brought up was that being around other people forced them into behaving like with attention. So they don't look at their phones. And if you look at your phone in a movie theater, you should be kicked out. But almost everyone does at home. It's like impossible not to. And so your attention is directed in a different way. And I think that's a big part of what the communal artistic experience can give us.
So I teach this class at the Yale Divinity School called Christ and Being Human. And we look at Jesus's life, his sort of narrated life and teachings, through the prism of different mundane phenomena of human existence. Mm-hmm. So we'll look at wealth and poverty, or food and eating habits, or mm-hmm. fashion. And last year I introduced a session on entertainment and boredom. And one of the things that was really exciting, but also very tricky and ultimately a little disconcerting, was just how absent those categories are in the sort of narrated life of Jesus and the way in which it's been reflected on by and large mm-hmm. in Christian tradition. And there's that famous quote from Gregory of Nazianzen, which he said, that which he has not assumed, he has not healed. Hmm. And as someone who's a follower of Jesus yourself, what do you take away from that silence? What do you think the place of entertainment, reading, watching, listening, what do you think the place of entertainment is in the flourishing life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I do think about what would have counted as entertainment when Jesus was walking the earth. And it takes some of the same like basic forms as what we do now. You would tell stories and you would sing songs, and that's most of it. You might create a visual thing, but even for most of human history, art, visual art, was a little different than how we conceive of it in our time. So telling stories and singing songs, and those were only communal. That was the setup, right? If you weren't in the same room with somebody, it wasn't happening. You could write it down, but again, like they might not be able to read it. So it's got to be this oral tradition, which I think that's true for most of human history. And so what we can see there is that there's something built into us from the start that makes us want to do those things. Singing is such a useless thing. And I mean, it doesn't actually have a use. Anything you can do, or what it seems like, anything you could communicate in a song, you could communicate with just words. But there's something else about it. I was just talking to someone about, there's a song that appears on many movie soundtracks by Max Richter, and I believe it's called like On the Nature of Daylight or something like that. It's in Arrival. It's in Shutter Island. There was a year where it was in like 7 movies at once. And I have always thought of it as the saddest song in the world. And if you listen to it, you'll know what I mean. I don't really know what it is about it that makes me so sad, but there's something there. There's some kind of a thing that's resonating with my insides. And I know people have studied this for a long time, but it's very evident. So those two things, they're communal in nature. And when we do them in a communal nature, whether it is that we engage with them on our own and then we come together and talk about them, there is like something that only is complete about the work of art when it's shared, whatever that looks like. And then I think the other piece of it that's been added when we've added more visual mediums and more ways to quickly create them, or like relatively low cost, and we have the means to engage with them, we're watching them on a movie screen or on our phone or whatever, is the discipline of attention, which I think about all the time, and that the artist has the ability to direct the attention of the audience. Like, that's a main thing that an artist can do, is if you agree to engage with their work, then they will show you something and you agree to pay attention to that thing. And visual mediums are especially good at this. When you're watching a film, and I'll just use Terrence Malick as an example because everyone does, but one thing he does really well is draw your attention to stuff that you normally might just walk past or you just wouldn't have seen to begin with. And I think one reason that I'm so insistent on not calling film a storytelling medium is that it's primarily not. It's primarily visual. Like, you could lose the sound, you could have no story, you could have no characters, but you can't have no images. You have to have images for it to be a film. That's just what it is in its essence. And so it really does direct our attention towards things. And I think the act of attending to things is basically the act of love. And when I look at the life of Christ, he's forever drawing people's attention to things as lessons, or just things they wouldn't have seen otherwise, a person they would have passed by, or like a lesson from nature, or something that they would have missed. So I'm not going to say like Jesus was a filmmaker, but there's certainly something there to what he was doing. And I think like that discipline and virtue of attention flies directly in the face of everything that we experience today. It's like the counterbalance. Even just coming down to sitting at a table with someone you love and not being able to stop fooling around with your phone, that's a vice. We know it is. But being able to learn to train our attention in one direction for 2 hours, that's something that a movie can give you that almost nothing else can.
Yeah, that's another sort of normative component to it, right? I mean, you are submitting yourself to another person's view, engagement with the world.
And their hospitality is often how I think about it. Good artists are hospitable. They're not just throwing something at you and being like, have fun. They're like, come here. I have something I want to show you. And you have to sit with it.
I have been chuckling nonstop every time I think about the title of your podcast, The Young Adult Movie Ministry. And I was wondering, in light of what you were just talking about, that there is a sort of, in a sense, this does fall under the auspices of a kind of ministry. If we want to think about it, watching and attending in this way, it's a ministry of attention. Why that title?
The easy answer is that my co-host came up with it, and he's much better at titling things than me. But originally we had batted around calling it something like Cornerstone Coffee House Film Night or something like that, just to get across. So we both grew up in evangelical churches. I thought that one might be a little opaque to some people, but it was like dead on for some population. We both grew up in evangelical churches, and we both remember, he was in the South, I was in the Northeast. And we both definitely remember like youth groups having movie night outreaches where it was like, we're going to come here, we're going to watch probably The Matrix, and then we're going to talk about it together. Lord of the Rings later. We're going to like have a discussion about it. And it's going to be basically a Bible story, but with a movie instead of a scripture passage or something like that. It's very tongue in cheek. We are not aiming to do a Bible study with a movie at all. And often we're like way out in the ozone on that level. But one thing we did want to do was create a space to talk about, we've always just called it Christianity and the movies, because some movies are Christian movies that we talk about. Some movies are not, but they deal with Christian things explicitly, like Silence or First Reformed. Some of them are only tangentially related, but there's something there that digs into the history, usually particularly of American evangelicalism, because that's something we're really familiar with, or other aspects. And we have guests, we've been going almost a year, we have guests a lot of the time, if not most of the time. And I would say at least half of them are not Christian at all, but they're interested in an aspect of a movie that is about nuns, or they've always loved one of our, I think our first guest actually was A.O. Scott from the New York Times, and he isn't a Christian, but he and I have long shared love of the movie Hail Caesar, because it's a movie about religions and Christianity and Hollywood and socialism, how all these things connect and overlap and diverge, and how people come to believe something. So it was like, what if your youth group's movie night was more open and free and able to discuss all kinds of things and also swear sometimes? And it's fun. It's very freewheeling.
One of the things that I've noticed that, so as a movie critic, I get you have to watch a lot of bad movies. It's part of your job. But I've noticed that even in your podcast, you still seem to include movies that you think are bad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There are good reasons to do this. A bad movie can instruct you as much as a good one. Also, some of them are very influential. So an early-ish one, I think we did last fall, was God's Not Dead, the first one. And part of the reason we did it was our friend Josh, who is a like big-time comedian and a comedy writer, and also just really sweet guy and not a Christian at all. He was like, yeah, my friends and I, when he worked at John Oliver's show, in their downtime, they would sit around watching Christian movies and just be like, baffled by them. Not angry, just baffled. Like, what's going on there? And so I think it's been much more fun to, because I have written extensively on those movies, which I think are kind of noxious. Those ones, and some of them are, you know, whatever, but that they're noxious. But I've written extensively on them. I have lots of reasons that I think they're bad, but it is more fun and I think more useful to other people to hear us talk to someone who's like, I don't find this offensive so much as just like weird. And like, it's not accomplishing the goals it set out to do. And sometimes every movie critic knows that a bad movie can be more fun to write about than a good one.
I've been reading your book. And what you just said reminds me of the way you conclude the book by talking about Daniel as the sort of patron saint of the book. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about how Daniel fits into that sort of responsibility to attend and in the places that we might not be predisposed or inclined to focus our attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was fun. So I co-wrote that book in 2015, and I always feel the need to clarify that we came up with the title, How to Survive the Apocalypse, years ago. And then it came out in May 2016, and it just feels like it's been nonstop apocalypse since. But it's proven very useful. So we're looking at ideas of apocalypse, but also of a secular age via Charles Taylor throughout, which is fascinating. And we look at it through the lens of apocalyptic pop culture. So by the time we've arrived at the end, we are thinking about, okay, so if apocalypse is a time when things are being renewed, like the reset button is being hit, then what are we supposed to be doing here? You know, if we read the biblical book of Daniel, he's living in an apocalyptic book of the Bible, one of the few, and he's seeing all these things, and it's a time of great turmoil for him and his people, and he's in exile. And what he decides to do is lean in and become chief of the court magicians, which is like a very odd thing to read in the Bible. He works actively for the good of the empire that he's living in. He's not engaging with it where he can't. Obviously, like the stories we know about Daniel and about his friends show the times where they were like, oh, I can't do that. But for the most part, they're in those positions because they've risen up to levels where they have responsibility because they've been working so hard to ensure things like flourishing. We see this with Joseph in Genesis, and there are these moments often where people feel like they're in exile. And we just felt like that was a better answer to the question of what do we do in an apocalyptic time, then, oh, we should retreat to the hills, or we should just stand on the street corners and holler at people. Like, there are different approaches to this, and this is the one that the pattern fits the time that we're in. I think it's really important for me because I teach undergraduates, and a lot of them are aiming to go out and work in the arts or work in theater or find ways to teach in the public schools or whatever it is that they're doing. And a lot of them have come from faith traditions where doing those things in and of itself is suspect, because why would you want to do that for the world? You can just do it for Jesus. I had one student who her mind was completely blown when she realized it was okay for her to want to work in theater without it being like Christian theater. It just like completely melted her brain because it was something nobody had ever said. And I think the Daniel paradigm gives people somewhere to go with that. It's a story we all grow up knowing and acting out in church, but it gives us an extra perspective on he is a righteous man, and that was a righteous thing for him to be doing. So that should change the way we think about what we're doing.
So on this sort of subject of the responsibility that Christians have to engage in, create art and entertainment, share it with others, you make this distinction in the book between viewing ourselves as authors and as half authors. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about how that changes the nature, the view of responsibility that we have in that, and why that's so important in understanding the sort of what kind of responsibility we might have as followers of Christ.
Yeah. So when we're creating as Christians, we are not wholly in control. Whoever you are, when you're creating something for people to engage with, the audience themselves are as much a part of the meaning-making experience as you are. For instance, in grad school, I wrote a thesis on Francis Schaeffer and how he thought about art, which he was very helpful to a lot of people. But in his book, Art and the Bible, which is very influential from the 70s, he had this really strong idea that if people misinterpret your work, it's like your fault and that you should have worked harder to make sure that they couldn't do that. And this is an impossibility, and it also doesn't give much agency or responsibility or even really treat the audience as if they're full humans. And so I think the only way that a Christian artist can trust that what they're doing is going to be on net benefit good out there is if they give themselves less stature in that place. Like, I'm the artist, but I'm the emissary. I'm a creator because I was created. And that's true of all artists. It's just that those of us who believe it think about it while we're doing it. And then also be able to hand it over to the audience and say, okay, this is what I've done. Now you take over and you make meaning out of it. And that interplay of meaning making, I think, is really important to me, both as a critic, because that's what I'm doing is making meaning, but also just to give artists a break themselves and to also steer them away from trying too hard to make propaganda with a one clear message that can't be misinterpreted any other way. Actually, you want that openness and that free play and that ability for someone who has a totally different life situation than you to come to your work and bring something new to it. That's really exciting. It's certainly what God did when he made the world. And so I think like that kind of a thing should delight us instead of scare us. But that is often has not been the case for a lot of Christians who work in the arts.
Yeah. Alleviate some of the burden from the authors who have to make sure that there's only one way of interpreting what they're saying. But it also seems to me that, at least the way I understand you using it, that it provides some constraints for the audience members and the interpreter. It is not just up to us to make meaning. It's dialogical.
Yes, that's
and
right.
I really loved what you were saying earlier about the watching in a communal setting. I was thinking about laugh tracks and how laugh tracks get such a bad rap. But actually, there's something to the fact that something makes other people laugh has something to say to you.
Or if people are crying around you, it gives you something. We're given interpretive frameworks by the people around us, and there's no reason that can't happen in real time. And it gives us that kind of permission and responsibility at the same time to treat the art with respect.
Recently, it seems to me that entertainment has been understood and viewed as a sort of cure for boredom. Increasingly, as entertainment becomes more pervasive, as it becomes more accessible, as the options increase, you started to see some sort of a nostalgia for boredom and arguments that actually what we need for our flourishing life is some sort of admixture between boredom and entertainment. Now, I have questions and reservations about that approach, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you see entertainment and as a good, and boredom as a good or bad, and what that means for your vision of the flourishing life.
So Michael Chabon, the novelist and also Hollywood script doctor, he wrote a really good piece for the LA Times probably 15 years ago now about reclaiming entertainment, the word entertainment, because he said, we have this idea that it's basically filler and it doesn't really matter what it is as long as it tickles your fancy in some way. And his argument in that is that, oh, entertainment is how we bridge the divide between people, that we're atomized and lonely and we live in our own heads and all these things, and that entertainment is what connects us. I think he says something like, it's an occupation worthy of artists, which I love that he thinks of it that way. But this is a guy who won a Pulitzer for writing a novel about kids writing comics. It's just terrific. And then he went and wrote the comic. And it's funny, C.S. Lewis makes almost exactly, like, word for word, the same argument in his book, An Experiment in Criticism, which is about how to be a good critic, basically. And it's a stealth jab at his detractors after his novels came out, who would say that, oh, it's genre fiction, so it's just entertainment, or it's for children, so it's just entertainment. And he says, no, this is how we bridge the divide. This is where we learn hospitality. This is how we find out what it is like to be another person. And that requires courage. And it also is like a good and human thing, maybe the most human thing that we can do. That's a lot of what I think about. And I think about how to arrange our entertainment in ways that will dig into those factors, while not saying that if you're going to watch a shabby TV show or something, that there's something wrong with you, because there isn't. But entertainment should be bigger than that, and it should be broader than that, and should be a place that we allow ourselves to enter those experiences. Mm. On the other hand, boredom is good for us, hands down. We know this. We know that neurologically, the fact that we're always on our phones is preventing us from developing short-term memories, which is bad in many ways. Also, culturally, we seem to be developing amnesia about things that happened last week or 3 years ago or whatever. And a lot of what passes for criticism out there these days often is just a product of cultural amnesia. So it's good for us to learn to do nothing. And this is going to sound really silly, because you'd think during the pandemic, being home all the time, I would have had more time to be bored. And at times I did. But what I found I missed the most was the doing nothing of commutes on the subway, of just sitting and thinking. And I'd be bored, sure. Sometimes I might listen to a podcast or something, but sometimes I would do nothing, because it's a place for contemplation and not feeling like something is coming and flying at me out of a screen all the time. And I think that's really key to what I would want out of life. I know when everything is bam, 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 I feel crazy. And learning to balance those things has been a big part of just becoming an adult, but also learning how to live in the world, especially when I need to look at a screen for so much of my day.
What role, what place does entertainment have in the life worth living?
I think it's vital. I don't trust a person who doesn't entertain themselves sometimes, or engage with it, or looks down on it, because I think it is too often a proxy for looking down on your fellow man or woman. So I think that entertainment is where we meet one another as much as anywhere else. And it's also a place where we have the ability to have fun and experience joy and pleasure, all of which are vital parts. Life is not worth living without those moments. And even in the most dire of circumstances, people find ways to enjoy and find pleasure in one another's company and one another's stories and goofy jokes and all of that stuff. And that's what entertainment is. It's just us all trying to make each other laugh and cry and know what it is to be me. And I think that's about the most deeply human thing I can imagine.
Alyssa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For the Life of the World is a production. production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture at Yale Divinity School. This episode featured film critic and journalist Alyssa Wilkinson and theologian Drew Collins. Production assistance by Martin Chan and Nathan Jowers. I'm Evan Rosa, and I edited and produced the show. For more information, visit us online at faith.yale.edu. New episodes drop every Saturday, with the occasional midweek. If you're new to the show, we're so glad that you found us. Remember to hit subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. And if you've been listening for a while, thank you, friends. If you're liking what you're hearing, I've got a request. Would you support us? It's pretty simple, really, and won't take much time. Here are some ideas. First, you could hit the share button for this episode in your app and send a text or email to a friend or share it to your social feed. Second, you could give us an honest rating on Apple Podcasts. How are we really doing? Finally, you could write a short review of the show in Apple Podcasts. Reviews are cool because they'll help like-minded people get an idea for what we're all about and what's most meaningful to you, our listeners. Thanks for listening today, friends. We'll be back with more this coming week.